Welcome to this IFRS Foundation podcast, which will focus on the November meeting of the International Accounting Standards Board. The meeting took place in London on the 14th and 15th of November 2018. My name is Matt Tilling. I'm a member of the technical staff here at the ISB. Today I'm joined by Vice Chair Sue Lloyd and Board Member Daryl Scott. And we're going to talk through the latest meeting and other developments. Daryl, let's get straight into the meeting. There was a discussion on IFRS 17 insurance again this week.
Yes, Matt, thanks very much. So at the last meeting, we agreed that we would look at certain aspects of the standard that had been raised through the consultative process that we followed through the last 15 months. And specifically at the October meeting, we set the criteria for how that discussion would work. And we decided in those criteria that any changes we made should not result in less useful information for investors. It shouldn't disrupt existing implementation processes, and it should not risk undue delays in the effective date of the standard. So that was the October discussion. This month what we discussed was whether or not we should change the effective date of IFRS 17. Now, as we're saying at this point, it's very unusual for us to discuss effective date this early in our deliberations, but we had heard a number of requests from preparers for us to provide certainty for them so that their implementation plans could continue along a more certain path. So the board decided, considering the possible disruptions that may be caused to implementation processes by us talking about potential changes to the standard, that it did make sense for us to provide an extra year to extend the effective date from 1 January 21 to 1 January 22. In the same discussion, we also talked about the temporary exemption to IFRS 9. Now, for those who don't know, IFRS 4 provides a temporary exemption to insurance companies from applying IFRS 9 until January 21. The board had the discussion about the extension of IFRS 9 after having decided on IFRS 17. And I think that's particularly important because the decision to make a one-year extension on 17 influenced our decision process around IFRS 9. We concluded that we would extend IFRS 9. It was a different discussion because essentially IFRS 9 is already live, it's already out there and it's already being used, and it does not have the same concerns that we had around 17, that the potential for changes. But we felt that it was important that, at least in the context of a short extension of 17, that 9 be applied along the same timelines, be applied at the same time. During the course of the discussion around effective dates, the question of whether or not the change in effective date would affect the endorsement processes of jurisdictions was raised. The board noted that although endorsement processes are something that we follow quite closely, we have no control over them and consequently they do not affect our decision making as we work through the process. And so consequently we don't believe this has any impact on our decision on effective dates.
Sue, the board continues to discuss primary financial statements and a number of decisions were made this month. One of those decisions was whether or not an earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortization, an EBITDA figure should be required.
And the short answer to that particular question is no. So the board decided not to require the presentation of an EBITDA-like number in the statement of financial performance or in the notes to the financial statements. But that led to quite a lengthy discussion of what the treatment of that type of subtotal should be, and in particular whether if an entity did produce an EBITDA-type number, whether that would be considered to be a management performance measure, which would then mean that particular reconciliation requirements would come with it in the decisions we've made to date. We got into such a long debate that went in so many different directions that in the end we decided it was best to ask the staff to do some more analysis and to come back and to make a decision based on an analysis of some of the issues that we had raised in the discussion, so that will come back. But we did decide not to require it, which is important. Another important topic that we discussed under the primary financial statements project was the question of whether the board should propose non-mandatory illustrative examples for different industries, and the board decided that we should proceed with that proposal and that we should ask the question that if we did have those types of illustrative financial statements, whether that should be some sort of an appendix to IAS 1 or whether that should be in a separate practice statement. And we decided to put that out for comment when we go out with the document on primary financial statements, and that we would expect to illustrate really the primary financial statements, so the income statement, the cash flow statement, etc., for a range of different types of industries, and also to illustrate some notes, but only some notes, not full financial statements, in particular to illustrate the notes that we've been discussing as part of the primary financial statements project. So, for example, what an example of the note that we propose to require on management performance measures could look like.
Daryl, the board also looked at management commentary, and specifically, it has been considering the objective of management commentary and guidance supporting the objective.
Yes, Matt, this is a project that is in still its fairly early days, and the staff has spent the last several months doing a lot of outreach with the various constituent bodies, including the working group that is being set up specifically for this purpose. And they used that to pull together the objectives and the context within which they believed management commentary should be placed. So the board decided that the objective of management commentary should be to give context to financial statements by providing primary users of the management commentary with the historical financial and operational information and with analysis that is useful to assess the prospects of the entity's future net cash flows. There's been quite a lot of discussion about this last point because people are looking for the management commentary to provide insight, but not necessarily to provide a mechanism for forecasting. And the board spent some time talking about how that distinction is drawn. The board expects to discuss this application of the application of materiality and the principles of management commentary further at its meeting in January next year.
So the board has been looking at the classification of liabilities and specifically current or non-current.
That's right. So the current non-current classification in IAS 1, and this is continuing the re-deliberations of an exposure draft that we issued quite some time ago now. And at the meeting, the board decided that IAS 1 should require an entity to classify a liability as current if the entity doesn't have a right at the end of the reporting period to defer settlement of that liability for at least 12 months after the reporting period. And that's not really a radical change at all from what's on IAS 1 today. It's really, I think, more in the nature of a clarification. In particular, today IAS 1 uses the words unconditional right, and I think there was a concern some people were overreading what that meant. What we talked about as part of the discussion was some additional clarification that we think could be helpful in IAS 1 that comes about really in response to some of the questions that were raised about application of the words in the comment letters. And the board decided that we should clarify that when you assess these rights, it needs to be a substantive right, or it has to have substance. So if there's a right to defer settlement, but it's on terms that nobody's ever going to use, then you wouldn't look at that as being really a right. And also to clarify that an entity's right to defer settlement isn't affected by whether or not you expect to use the right. So if management might not choose to extend, that doesn't matter. It's whether they have the right that matters. And also, even if a liability happened to be settled between the end of the reporting period and the date the financial statements are authorised for issue, that doesn't change the classification of the instrument as at the reporting date, because the question is, at the reporting date, what rights did you have? And so we decided to proceed with those clarifications.
Daryl, it was a big month for rate-regulated activities.
Yeah, Matt, we're drawing towards the end of the current phase of this project, and so the staff brought a suite of papers to us that get into some of the final issues that we just need to tick off on and get some comfort on in terms of some specific details of the standard. Now, I'm going to pick up on some of the high points, but to the extent that anybody is following this very closely, I'd probably direct you to look at the papers to see some of the real specific issues that we did get into. I think the first issue that we discussed was the applicability of other standards to the model that we're talking about. And this was done largely in the context of using the existing IFRS 14, which is a temporary standard on rate regulated, as a bit of a template to direct us to the issues where previously the board has decided that other standards should not have an implication on the model. So the first of the topics that we discussed was IFRS 5 and IAS 36. And in both of these cases, the board agreed with the staff view that because the rate-regulated model currently has a strong current element to it in the remeasurement process that occurs, it was unnecessary to apply those two standards as an overlay to the process. And so we were comfortable to essentially exempt the measurement model from the requirements of both IFRS 5 and IAS 36. That discussion continued into IFRS 3 and whether the requirement to remeasure at fair value should be applied in the context of the model. The board felt that there wasn't sufficient information for us to make a conclusion on this particular aspect, and we requested that the staff bring us back further guidance on whether or not the regulatory assets and liabilities identified in an acquisition should be remeasured at fair value or not. Or whether you can continue to use the existing carrying value. The rest of the focus of the discussion was primarily on presentation and disclosure. On presentation, the board generally agreed with the staff proposals, except for the specific staff proposal that would have allowed some rate adjustments to be reflected in OCI. Mm. In that circumstance, the board felt that this was something that seemed to be out of sync with the way we'd been thinking about the model to that point, and asked the staff to take it away and think about that issue again, and in need, bring it back to us for further consideration. The final issue that we discussed at the meeting was disclosure. In particular, on the disclosure topics, what the staff had done is they had used the thought process that had been developed under the Disclosure Initiative Project to develop a process for thinking about what disclosures we should be considering. And I think the board largely, with some minor adjustments, thought or agreed to that thought process and the outcome of the thought process, although it was noted in this discussion and the previous discussion that we still need to proceed with disclosures in our normal process. We can't yet adopt the direction that the Disclosure Initiative is taking. So we allowed the process to help develop our thinking, but the conclusion that we're likely to land at in this project is likely to be more along the lines of the way we've dealt with previous projects.
So the board discussed a couple of what I think are quite interesting implementation issues this week. The first was around how to account when an entity earns income from the sale of goods before an asset is ready for use, something that you might see, say, in the extractives industry.
That's right. So what we're doing here really is re-deliberating an exposure draft we put out a while ago, which proposed that these proceeds should be treated as sales. To clarify, they shouldn't be offset against the capitalisation of the PP&E. And this has raised some, I think, quite interesting issues in practice and certainly generated a lot of debate. Now, the staff had actually recommended a relatively light touch in response to the feedback that we got, moving more to a sort of disclosure type solution, but the board felt more strongly than that. So the board has decided to instead move forward with what we talked about as the modified form of the exposure draft, which would include clarifying the meaning of testing activities, specifying that testing whether an item of property, plant and equipment is available for use is based on a technical and physical assessment of the asset rather than its financial performance. And so we plan to move forward with that.
The second issue is one that we've spoken about a number of times, cryptocurrencies. There have been calls for the board to write a standard addressing this issue specifically. However, the board has decided not to add this to the work plan. Could you take us through the thinking here?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one, and we actually talked about it at the board in July, and at that time the board said they would like the Interpretations Committee to have a look at this question to confirm what they thought the current accounting requirements were and to get some feedback on sort of the appropriateness, I guess, of that accounting. And the committee looked at that. So this discussion was about the feedback we'd got from the Interpretations Committee. And in addition to, what's the accounting, the other thing that we've been grappling with as well is that even though there's a lot of discussion about cryptocurrencies in the market generally, when you look at IFRS financial statements, it's not very often at all that we actually see people having to account for holdings of cryptocurrencies. So I think the board's had a real challenge in terms of working out, is it important enough that we commit resources to standard setting on this when we've got a queue of projects that people would like us to work on? And so it was really largely a discussion about that. Now, when it went to the committee had looked at the accounting and decided that today IAS 38 would apply unless it was inventory and IAS 2 would apply. And so we gave that feedback to the board. And the upshot is, after much debate, that the board decided that we shouldn't do any standard setting in this area, that there's really not a case for standard setting at the moment, given how often this question's coming up for IFRS reporters. We are, of course, interested in this, so the board will continue to monitor this and see whether the situation changes and justify standard setting in the future. But in the interim, that the board will ask the Interpretations Committee to issue an agenda decision that confirms the analysis that we had asked them to do.
Well, thank you both. That brings us to the end of the November podcast. So thank you, Sue. Thank you, Daryl. And thank you to our listeners. Any feedback on these podcasts, please email communications@ifrs.org. As always, the full summary of the board's discussion and the decisions at the November meeting can be found in the ISB update on the IFRS Foundation's website. Thank you very much.